to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I am Ursula Rudenberg, your host for today. Thank you for joining us. This weekend, Freak Week, an Ames tradition comes back to life. We'll talk about that, and in the second half of this hour, we will bring you a conversation with two residents of Ankeny. They're mental health workers who recently traveled to Louisiana with the Iowa Red Cross. And we'll get an update on election polls from new KHOI reporter Whitney Wright. But first, the weather. Lovely days ahead. Sunny today with a high of 78 and clear all night with a low of 54 degrees. Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, the days will be sunny and clear nights. Continue with temperature highs in the mid to upper 70s and lows at night in the 50s. Sunday through Monday, expect around 50% chance of rain, but temperatures are expected to go up just a little bit with days in the low 80s and nights continuing in the mid 50s. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm your host, Ursula Rudenberg, and the music we just heard is a historical recording made in the Ames Arboretum in 1989. That's Red's band. The leader, Red, or Larry Stoltenberg, is here, and that recording of you, Red, was part of the Ames tradition, Freak Week. You recognize that music, Red?
Yeah, I do. I was looking at some of that online the other day that somebody shot video. Yeah, I remember those days.
Musicians Ron Carson and Ken Johnson are also here to talk about Freak Week. What is happening this weekend with Freak Week? Kent Johnson.
We've got two events. Saturday night, we have just kind of a little pre-Freak Week party at the bar in Northern Lights, north of Walmart. And then the big event, the main event, is Sunday, September 4th. It's at DG's Tap House. It starts at 5 o'clock. The music starts at 5:30. There will be some finger food, so we're hoping people will show up early to munch and visit and listen to some acoustic folk music, starting out with Happy Jack, and then following with Morrison and Schmidt. After that, the electric music starts at 7 o'clock, and we will have a great lineup of music from, you know, Freak Week Past.
Freak Week Past.
Yes.
Ron Carson, local Ames musician.
I'm the voice of Freak Week Past.
Tell us, how did Freak Week start? What is this tradition?
Well, it was a tradition that was hatched, of course, as an original concept at some point. And that point was 1976. I was not there to witness the conception, but it was hatched over a bong in Marianne Roberts' living room. The discussion was, you know, they have residence hall week, they have Greek week. We need Freak Week for us. That's exactly what it was. It was a countercultural event that was hatched, and I did get in on the organizing committee, which was, you know, a bunch of people meeting in, once again, Marianne Roberts' living room and talking about the concept, which became a celebration of alternatives, Freak Week, a celebration of alternatives.
In 2012, the Ames Tribune quoted you in saying it was a group of people in a quest for community and a way to define community, Ron Carson said. We all formed around music. It was kind of a family. It's kind of a tribal thing. Would you agree that that was an accurate description that you gave?
Fairly accurate. You know, that guy is, you know, full of crap. And it didn't start out so much with music, although, you know, we always gathered around music, you know, if it's a concert or if it's just the turntable in the living room, we always gathered around that, and it did naturally become more that. But we're looking at non-mainstream lifestyles. So the first year, it was gatherings at the hallowed ground of the counterculture, which is just south of the Campanile on Central Campus at ISU, a place where lots of gatherings, informal and more formal, had occurred. Mm-hmm. I can remember the first year, 1976, that we had Karm from the Sikh ashram.
Kundalini Yoga Center.
Yeah, they're sitting cross-legged, talking into a microphone about meditation and such. And I don't know what else there was, but it was, you know, Monday through Friday that week. The next year, 1977, was, I believe, when they had the first music, and that was the Kilowatt Pioneers at the Memorial Union, Friday or Saturday evening. I can't remember. I was working a second shift machining job then, so I missed it. But I know flowers were presented to the band. You know, it continued year after year, different people.
This was basically started, it really actually didn't start with music. It started with some sort of alternative party.
Yeah. It was very derivative of Greek Week. It even rhymes, you know. Yeah, it was a celebration of alternatives, you know. It's we were against the mainstream culture that brought us the Vietnam War, although these organizers didn't have to worry about being drafted into Vietnam. There are some of us that are older that did have to face things like draft induction physicals.
So they were riding on the coattails of the counterculture that had been built up in the early 70s.
Well, in my age group was really riding on the original Ames hippies like Tom Richards, who was an Ames native at the time, and Ames mobilization, you know, the anti-Vietnam movement.
Mm-hmm. Is the event that's happening at DG's Tap House this Sunday, is it also a celebration of counterculture, or is it more just a celebration of the tradition of music?
Yeah, I think the latter.
Uh-huh.
I mean, it evolved over the years, you know, 1976 to 1992, that's 16 years. So obviously it changed because, you know, we have turnover here in a college town, you know, about every 4 or 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's a new group of people. As it evolved, you know, it centered more on the music, which is kind of a spring celebration is what it became. Is I think always in May.
And now it's in fall. Kent, can you talk a little bit about what exactly is going to happen at DG's Tap House?
The music will go till 12:30 a.m., and we've got the first electric band. I mentioned the two acoustic acts. The first electric band will be Jebediah Stone, and even though they didn't perform at a Freak Week, they were from the early years. They've been together for 40 years, and I think they formed in 1972, so I guess my math would say 44 years. So we're privileged to have them, and then after that, myself and my twin brother play, and we have guest musicians. One includes Mr. Ron Carson on bass, and we've got Ray England on congas, Todd Cummings on drums. After that, we have Billy Kearney, and he's going to bring his band Floodplain. And then we have Mal Ombre featuring Larry Red. And then after that, we have Curtis Mookie Bird, who's coming from Atlanta, Georgia.
And he's performing as well?
Yes, he is.
And what kind of music is he performing?
It's mostly a blues band. So we're going to have a wide variety of styles of music, jam music, blues music. We wanted to have reggae, but we couldn't slip that in there. Of course, acoustic folk and kind of a Grateful Dead style music as well.
I'd like to mention that Rick Weiss from Jebediah Stone was heavily connected with Kilowatt Pioneers, which is, by my recollection, the very first musical act for Freak Week.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in central Iowa. I'm your host, Ursula Rudenberg, and that was Freaks Don't Want No Freaks by the Eagles. I'm here with Red, Larry Stoltenberg, Ron Carson, Ken Johnson, and we're talking about Freak Week, an Ames tradition that's been with us since the
1976.
It is rolling around again this Sunday at DG's Tap House on Sunday evening. And in 2012, again, the Ames Tribune called Freak Week a long and fascinating local heritage that spans decades and generations. We are here to talk about the latest installment of that heritage. Red is with us, Larry Stoltenberg, from Red's band, and you're going to be performing again on Sunday. And your band kind of ruled. It headlined for many, many of the Freak Week events that happened in the past. So I was wondering if you could describe a little bit your impressions of the festival over the years from the point of view of somebody who was on stage so many times.
The first one I think I played at was 78, maybe at the Noon Arboretum. And then I remember 79 playing at the Arboretum in a different location then. But that was a good crowd then. And I think the one late 80s one, somebody estimated 5,000 people in attendance. That might be a bit high, but it was...
That's like a music festival.
Yes, it really was. I mean, it really was. It got bigger and bigger. We always had it the first weekend last weekend in April, I think, before Visha at the time.
And 1 week after Greek Week, I believe,
yeah,
or 1 or 2 weeks.
Because a lot of people, as Ron talked about, they felt they weren't part of the residence hall system. They weren't part of the Greek system. So they wanted their own thing, and it evolved, as Ron said. It seemed to get better every year, and I think the last one in 1990, it was just fabulous. The weather always cooperated, it seemed like, and just the hillside full of people and people wandering around, just good spirits everywhere. You can see some of that footage online. It's just...
And psychedelic drugs. There's one Saturday celebration at Brookside Park, that 78, I believe, when I played there.
In 2012, it was in the maintenance shop.
That was the first reunion year, wasn't it?
Second one. The first one was at People's down in Des Moines.
That's right, yeah.
2011. Mm-hmm. May of 2011.
Mm-hmm. So, Ron, you mentioned drugs. Red, you mentioned large, pretty sizable crowds. So these became policed events, I can imagine, because these were major crowd control scenarios.
As the Greek system co-opted the event, and due to bad behavior on their part, they were curtailed in their activities. So they started showing up to Freak Week instead, and so alcohol became much, much more prevalent, as did broken glass.
I remember, the one incident of throwing cans and bottles, and I just thought, it just ruined the whole thing. It was such a great event before.
What made the event great?
Just everybody coming out, and the spirit of fellowship, and like Ron said initially, gathered around the music, and it was just a real nice thing. And then they started showing up and throwing bottles and cans, and the last one I attended, it was really dark. It reminded me of Altamont. I kept thinking something was going to happen.
It was a beautiful day in hell.
It was dark, cloudy skies, and there was somebody up there saying, "You need to disrespect the police." And I just felt something's bound to happen. Nothing did, but I think that was kind of the death knell, at least from what I saw of Freak Weekend.
There weren't any Visha floats to burn, or otherwise that would have gone up in flames.
Yeah, I just thought that was the end of a real good tradition.
And was it the end?
1992 was the end.
That might have been the year.
Mm-hmm. Who organized these events?
Students, I believe, that are sitting at a bar in Dugan's talking about it and planning it. I think it was like a committee, because I think it was an ISU-sanctioned event.
I think it was IPERG, the Iowa Public Institute Research Group, was the university sponsor.
Yeah, so mm-hmm. I mean, I think it was an official university group behind it, and mm-hmm.
People's provided the PA the last few years, and People's was also a big Greek bar, so that naturally brought more of the Greek community in there.
So do I detect somewhat of a polarization and a hostility here between
the Greeks? Don't want no freaks.
They'll come to our party. I remember playing at one of their events in the spring, but I think they had some trouble, and I think they had to have dry events or something, so they started coming over to Freak Week, and that bottle throwing incident, I hated to see that. But
so have you notified the fraternities, Kent, that Freak Week is happening at DG's Tap House?
All are welcome. That's all I so all okay. are welcome. And I will say this too, that many of us so-called freaks. Now, I didn't belong to the Greek system, but many of my friends who I've stayed in touch with over the years were once Greek, and I guess we made them freaks, turned them into freaks.
All the Greeks that I knew were eventually kicked out of their fraternity house for smoking something.
Okay, well, we called the Greek fraternities and asked them to comment. Got no comments. So.
Well, just we kidding. We are just inclusive. Is, we are more inclusive than they are.
Yes, they're, please come.
This is a very biased crowd here we're talking to.
Well, there's no song called The Freaks Don't Want No Greeks. There is no such song.
Yeah, it was all inclusive, all welcoming, but and I don't know if that was all Greeks that were throwing bottles in cans. I think somebody told me that.
But
that,
somehow
that was
it started.
The case. Yeah, it was sad.
Yeah, so it was kind of a foreshadowing of the riots that started to happen on Welch Avenue eventually.
Yeah, it may have been.
That and idea is probably hatched right there. Yeah, we should burn some stuff.
So Kent, would you tell us again exactly what's going to happen on Sunday at TG's Tap House and when?
Okay, it is this Sunday, September 4th, begins at 5. Actually, the doors open at 4. We're going to have some finger food at 5. It's going to go until it runs out. So we're hoping that finger food will invite people to come early for the whole event, not just part of the event. So starting with acoustic music and starting with the electric music at 7 o'clock out until 12:30. And it might even go a little later than that.
And it's basically a reunion of an Ames tradition, which started out at the beautiful beginning and came to an ugly end, as far as I
learned. It was a lot of fun.
And is kind of a chance for folks to reminisce again and for newcomers to see some of the people like both Ron and Larry and you, Kent, too, as well, who have really been playing music in Ames since the 1970s. So it is really a tradition of...
Yes, you have.
It's really a tradition of music in Ames that's being celebrated. Thank you for coming at TG's Tap House. Spirits in the Night by Mel Ombre, and they'll be playing at DG's Tap House this Sunday night at the Freak Week reunion. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, your host for this hour. Whitney Wright is here. She's a new volunteer reporter for the Local Talk team. This is her maiden voyage on Local Talk. Welcome, Whitney.
Thank you for having me.
Whitney's here to give an update on the election polls. And so, Whitney, where do the current presidential candidates currently stand in the polls?
Well, according to Monmouth University Polling Institute, as of August 29, 2016, Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton holds an overall 7-point lead against Republican nominee, hers being 46 to his 39%. Coming in after Trump is Libertarian nominee Gary Johnson with 7%, followed by Jill Stein, the Green Party nominee, with 2%.
It's being said that the election is more personality-based during this election cycle than usual, and it's less on issues and more on personality. Based on your research, would you agree with that?
Yes. Based on what the polls are telling us currently, I would say this is a personality-based election.
So why do you say that?
Attention is mostly being based around the candidates' personal lives. The public is deprived the opportunity to learn about the candidates' stances on national issues America is facing and how they intend to deal with them. In my strict opinion, I believe voters need information on how the candidates will handle current issues.
Okay, so can you give an example of an issue that you think we should be discussing in relation to the candidates?
Yes. One example is the news about mass shootings that has caused a division and unrest among voters in the absence of knowing the candidates' plans on issues like gun control. Following the Pulse nightclub mass shooting in Orlando back in June, a CNN poll showed that 55% of Americans were in favor of stricter gun laws, the highest since the Newton Elementary shooting back in 2012. Of those participating in the CNN poll, 92% favored expanded background checks, 87% favored prohibiting convicted felons, 85% were in support of those on terrorist watch lists and no-fly lists were banned, and 9% for support full banishment of all gun ownership for all Americans.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, let's look at the remarks of each following candidate since the Pulse shooting. Libertarian nominee Gary Johnson doesn't believe more stricter laws are necessary, since some current laws are not very affected, though he says we should be more open to discussions preventing those with mental health issues from being able to obtain them. Republican nominee Donald Trump shares similar opinions, agreeing that those with mental health issues should be banned, including those on watch and no-fly lists, but he is opposed to gun laws because they give Americans a sense of personal security.
Because guns do, not
yes.
the laws.
Oh, yes.
Uh-huh.
Green Party candidate Jill Stein, however, favors stricter gun control and a strong need for local and national background checks. She says gun violence should be treated as a mental health issue with and tight regulation on gun sales, along with Democratic nominee Hillary Clinton renewing her call for gun control after the shooting. Agree that law-abiding citizens should keep their guns, but believe there is a need for stricter laws geared toward watch and no-fly lists that would exploit loopholes in existing gun laws.
So that's somewhat a continuation of the Obama administration's position on
yes,
gun
sir.
Control.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And all candidates favor a ban on assault weapons, except Trump, who seems to have changed from being in favor of the ban to saying on his website, opponents of gun rights try to come up with scary sounding phrases like assault weapons, military style weapons, and high capacity magazines to confuse people. What they're really talking about are popular semi-automatic rifles and standard magazines that are owned by tens of millions of Americans.
So Whitney, so we've been talking about the issue of gun violence and how the public has responded to, you know, large events of mass shootings, and how the candidates are talking about gun control themselves and how to deal with gun violence. You'll be returning soon to Local Talk with more poll updates, hopefully.
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, thank you. And at that time, let's cover another relevant issue during election time and see how the candidates respond to them and how the public has responded to various public issues as well.
I look forward to that. I don't think we should disregard trustworthiness in their potential presidents, but as we draw closer to November, it is also important to discuss the other issues in order to be well-informed about the candidates.
And you're saying trustworthiness has been the main basis on which opinion has been forming in the polls?
Yes.
Currently.
Yes, most definitely.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you, Whitney Wright, KHOI reporter and poll watcher. Thank you for joining us, and please come back soon.
It was a pleasure.
This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm Ursula Rudenberg, and your host for today. And Whitney Wright is here. She's a new member of the Local Talk team. And on Wednesdays, we usually travel outside of Ames to somewhere in central Iowa. Richard and Carolyn Newkirk are residents of Ankeny. They are mental health workers. They recently went to Louisiana with the Red Cross to be of help. And as you know, in August, prolonged rainfall caused rivers and waterways to reach record levels in Louisiana. Rainfall exceeded 20 inches, and the result was flooding that submerged thousands of homes and businesses in Louisiana and Baton Rouge. Louisiana's Governor John Bel Edwards called the disaster a historic, unprecedented flooding event and declared a state of emergency in many areas. The flood has been called the worst U.S. natural disaster since Hurricane Sandy in 2012. Richard and Carol in Newkirk are mental health workers. They have joined us by phone. You are actually in Louisiana. Thank you for joining us this morning. I really appreciate it. We really appreciate you sharing your firsthand knowledge and experience. You are our eyes and ears right now to tell us what is actually happening in Louisiana. First of all, tell us why you went down there with the Red Cross.
I just feel it's important to give back to the community, and we've been really blessed throughout our lives and just recently retired, so it's a time in life when we can travel and be flexible. And as mental health workers, we just felt the need to reach out and help the people that are going through just unbelievably devastating circumstances.
So what are you doing down there?
Well, we're mental health workers, as you said, and our first assignment was for me to be the mental health lead in two buildings in downtown Baton Rouge. If you can picture an exhibition center and an arena where they hold professional events, for those of my friends back in Iowa, it would be two buildings attached that are somewhat bigger, each of them bigger than Vets Odd. And there were 1,900 people on cots in those two facilities with a high presence of military police as well as local police. And as I said, I was assigned the position of mental health lead. I had six other mental health workers helping me, as well as working with a number of physicians and nurses to just meet the needs of the 1,900 people that were homeless in that facility. It was a city unto itself. The cots were probably 8 to 12 inches apart. You had families there together. You had every situation imaginable. And so a long answer, but the mental health people were trying to meet the needs of people who are grieving, people who had severe mental health needs, people who were had been on drugs, people just of every sort of situation that you can imagine.
What was the general feeling in these large halls?
You know, it was all over the place. We dealt with people that were just grateful to be alive because they had had friends that had lost their life. We had people that were grieving and crying. We had little kids who were happy. We had little kids that were grieving as well. So the range of emotions is all over the board.
Can you describe a normal day? When you got up in the morning, what did you do all day?
Well, there was no such thing as normal, but you know, when we were there first thing in the morning, of course, there was a meeting to try to make sure that we were organized and knew what had happened in the night shift, because we try to staff the place on two shifts, 8 to 8 and 8 to 8. And so there's directors for all of the different types of needs. There's a director of the shoulder, then there's a person who's in charge of mental health, there's a person who's in charge of the health services. So you come together to find out what the needs are. But a typical day, which there is no typical, you're reaching out to every type of situation imaginable. One of the things that did bless us is there was a man there who had lost everything, but he had been in a car wreck in 2001, and he was burned very badly. He had an arm that was amputated. He had a part of a foot that was amputated. He had no nose or ears and was blind. And he was just thankful that he had his life, thankful that he had every day. So if you can imagine that person sitting in a wheelchair talking about how he's just grateful for life because he got out of the flood, or his wife got him out of the flood. So we're counseling that type of person, to children, to helping drug addicts that have had been on a bad trip and they had gotten drugs into the center. And so it's just every need that you can imagine.
And were you literally walking down the aisles between the cots, or was there some area where you could meet with people, or how does counseling like this happen in such a scenario?
Why don't I let my wife answer
okay.
that one? Can I?
Thank you. Absolutely.
Actually, we did walk throughout the whole arena and exhibition center and walk place to place, and people would say, hey, ma'am, you know, and have questions. We did everything from point them to other places that where services were, to answering questions that they need. So it was very interesting. We also did have a place where people could come and talk to us. So, again, as Rich said, things were across the board. They were just all-inclusive.
And how did people know that you were somebody there as a resource to help them?
Well, you're wearing your Red Cross vest at all times and a lanyard so that that people can see who you are. And then there was an area that was designated as health services, and then we did function out of that health services area.
Mm-hmm. Carolyn, what was one of the most memorable things that you experienced in that hall?
I guess probably it was a sad thing. I had a little 2 or 3 year old boy handed over to me crying because his mom and dad had just walked out of the shelter and left him behind. And that breaks my heart.
Yeah.
You know, and so trying to keep families together and yeah. So that was one of those sad things.
Are these people still in the hall or have they returned to their homes, or what's happened to these people?
A lot of them are still there. There are people who have moved out. They've found friends, family to live with. FEMA has provided some money for them to be in a motel for a while.
Mm-hmm.
The problem there is there aren't motel rooms. Many of our Red Cross staff are still in shelters laying, sleeping on cots.
Mm-hmm.
So it's crazy down here, believe me.
Yeah. Where are you staying?
We are currently in a motel. We started out in a shelter but did get moved to a motel.
Mm-hmm. Now, as I understand it, you went to a different from community after Baton Rouge. Is that correct?
Yes. We went to Denham Springs, and I'm glad you asked that question because trying to describe what we met there is just beyond any type of description. If you could imagine a whole community for miles or part of a community there in Des Moines, say West Des Moines or Ankeny, and as far as you can see, every home being gutted and all of your stuff at the curb. So as you go down a street, these people have had time now to go back into their homes and put all of their possessions at the curb, refrigerators, stoves, TVs, every bit of their contents is at the curb, and all the sheetrock, because the houses have been stripped. So if you can possibly imagine going down a street with just mounds and mounds of stuff at the curb, one could not even imagine how long the cleanup will take.
Mm-hmm.
For these communities. I do have a copy of yesterday's newspaper that I'm reading for you. It says more than 80% of the structures in just the Livingston Parish took water. They're estimating just in that parish that the cleanup will be $22 billion, and the buildings that took in water were somewhere, because they can't get a hold of it, somewhere between 60,000 and 74,000 structures took in water in just the Livingston Parish.
And the parishes here are like our counties back in Iowa. So just one county, one parish had that much damage. And by the way, when you started talking or someone said there was over 20 inches of rain. Some places had over 30 inches.
Wow. Wow. Now, is this Livingston, are you talking, is this a town outside of Baton Rouge?
Livingston is a town, but it's also the equivalent of our counties. There's a Livingston Parish.
Uh-huh.
So think of that as Livingston County.
Yeah.
And that particular area, 60,000 to 74,000 buildings took in water.
Wow, 30 inches of rain. That's a lot of rain. That's
You're going to think that we're keep making up the story, but when we first got here, we were told 24 inches. Then we got out on the beat, and some papers came out and said 30 inches. And then we got into Denham Springs and started talking to some of the people, and the highest area recorded was 35 inches in 48 hours.
That's incredible. The people, the people in this town that you're describing, where are they? I mean, they can't be, where are they living?
Well, that is the problem. They're dispersed everywhere, just like after Katrina. Some of them have moved to friends in Mississippi or New York or wherever.
Mm-hmm. Some are in tents.
Yeah, some are in tents. We met the needs of people who needed tents, and so we had a friend who was distributing tents. But the other problem that we've got is you're talking about an area that's devastated, that's in a flood zone, so FEMA's there, and literally trying to decide, in some cases, organizations are trying to decide whether people should rebuild.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the interesting situations is, as I described, all these homes have been gutted and everything is at the curb. And, of course, you can't imagine the stench because we get rain every day down here.
Mm-hmm.
But the next problem is they can't do phase two of having people come in and fix their homes until they can get a permit. And right now, permits are not being issued because there needs to be a consensus and a decision made whether the people are going to have homes demolished or whether they can rebuild, and whether all the governmental agencies decide on what's going to happen with the homes. So people are in
limbo,
are in the pause mode.
Mm-hmm.
Because they just can't get into their homes to fix them. They can gut them and put the stuff at the curb, but the next mm-hmm. step just can't happen yet.
So they're homeless and in limbo.
They're homeless
yeah.
and in limbo.
Yeah.
So they're in everything from tents next to their house to living with loved ones to moving to other states and other cities.
Mm-hmm.
It's just
shelters.
It's all over the board.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're in Baton Rouge again now?
We're in a motel right now, but we leave today at 2 o'clock to come back to Des Moines,
okay.
which is interesting because now the forest fires are calling people's names out in the West Coast.
So as you drive, as you fly back to Des Moines, what do you think this is all going to mean to you?
Well, such a feeling of gratitude. You know, I go out and give brain workshops, and one of the things that we teach is that, you know, when you're giving to others, the person that gets the most blessing is the person that's doing the giving. And so, you know, it almost sounds selfish, but you leave here with just a sense of gratitude from the angle that you haven't gone through something like this, but the other thing is just being grateful that you can touch people's lives and get them a tent and get them their medicine and
mm-hmm.
and just help them in some small way in this unbelievable time of need.
And there'll be individuals that you remember?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we're already talking about the fellow that I described earlier that has no nose, no ears, he's blind. One of the physicians one day said to me, and I was working closely with the physicians, he said he had a headache and he had not met the gentleman yet. So I took him over and had him meet this gentleman that I described. And after we got done and walked back, I said, "How's your headache?" And, you know, that's kind of an extreme case of that gentleman, but these people are in such a time of need that when you look at your own situation, you become so grateful for what you have. And I guess that's kind of what we take away from it.
Also, we were here in March for the flooding, and we have met people who lost everything in March, had just been reestablished for about a month, now have lost everything again. And again, as Rich says, as you go home, you realize when we get off the plane, we're going to a home.
You're going home. Mm-hmm.
We have a bed. We have food in the pantry. We have food in the refrigerator. We are totally blessed.
Well, thank you. We've been speaking with Richard and Carolyn Newkirk from Ankeny, who are residents in Ankeny, and they're mental health workers who recently were in Louisiana to bring assistance to folks after the disastrous rainfall and flooding that occurred there. Thank you, Richard and Carolyn, for being our eyes and being able to bring us down to Louisiana and hear firsthand what's happening. And thank you for your work down there.
Our pleasure.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
There's a place where words mean nothing, are much less. Such a disgrace, we gotta get out of this mess. Coming in under the cover of darkness, how high shall we build this wall? Could have said more, but it would have seemed heartless. How hard did I slam that door? There's a town I know, has a strange resemblance to Jericho. Even though seven horns are getting ready to blow, coming in under the cover of darkness, how high shall we build this wall? Could have said more, but it would have seemed heartless. How tight shall we close that door? Yeah.
That's Broken Promised Land by Elvis Costello and Alan Toussaint. And we lifted that song from a show called Down the Road, coming out of WHYR Community Radio in Baton Rouge. Robert Sherman is the producer and host of Down the Road at WHYR. And Robert is with us by phone. Robert, welcome to KHOI.
Thank you.
We play your show here on KHOI in Iowa every Friday at 2 p.m. Thank you for bringing us the sounds of Baton Rouge on a weekly basis. You were in New Orleans to help with the Katrina disaster, as well as experiencing the recent flooding in Baton Rouge. Can you tell us how similar the two events were?
Well, they were similar in a lot of ways in that they involved a lot of water.
Yeah,
and they involved, you know, many tens or even hundreds of thousands of homes being flooded. But then there were a lot of differences too. Obviously, the way the water came. But for Katrina, it was more wind and storm surge, whereas this one in the Baton Rouge area was just rain, strictly rain. You know, things looked much different. The after effect was very similar. I think your previous guest described, you know, driving down the streets, it looked like alleyways just because the contents of houses were piled up by the curb. So, you know, all the houses are gutted and everything. But for the most part, in this one, the infrastructure remains. So, you know, hasn't been damaged by the winds and by the storm surges. Hopefully, this one we will be able to get back on our feet a little more quickly. Just because in some areas after Katrina, it was total devastation.
Right.
Starting from absolutely nothing. I think there were very few, if any, areas where we had, you know, that much devastation. Although probably some places were, you know, obviously very, very bad off.
As a resident of Baton Rouge, I'm curious what your feeling is about how an event like this will affect the city. I mean, this was a city that was already experiencing a struggle over political division prior to the event, and now this. As a resident of the city, what does this add up to for you?
Well, for one thing, this event that occurred a couple of weeks ago is generally called the Baton Rouge flood, or is thought of that. But and many areas of Baton Rouge did get flooded, but it was more widespread than that. The previous guests mentioned Denham Springs, and last week I did some time working in Denham Springs, and yeah, that area caught it much worse. And then I guess not as well publicized, but across the Mississippi River over by Lafayette, there was a lot of flooded areas from this event. So there, you know, it was much more widespread than simply Baton Rouge. That said, you know, Baton Rouge obviously, you know, we did take a hit on this, but you know, there was a lot of devastation. There was, you know, a lot of misery, you know, a lot of damage, but there was also a lot of humanity, people coming together to help out and to work.
So in some ways, people were brought together as well by the disaster as well as being uprooted.
Oh, yes, yes. Mm-hmm. People come together. You see the people working together. The shootings of the police in, was it July? It seems like It seems like years ago. You know, that definitely caused a rift within people, within, you know, people of different political philosophies, different races, different, you know, socioeconomic classes. This event, for better or for worse, in a lot of ways brought people back together again.
Mm-hmm.
Just everybody working to fix the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you know, there was a common enemy here, and it was not, you know, it was not the police, it was not the Democrats, it was not the Republicans, it was, you know, it was nature, and it was, you know, it was a war to be, or a battle to be fought here, and everybody joined in to fight it. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, it did help to bring people together.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, for better or for worse, obviously it's a tragedy, but you take out of it what you can.
Right. Well, thank you, Robert. The clock is running out on us, but Robert, thank you for joining us for a few minutes. And Robert Sherman is the host of Down the Road, a program from WHYR Community Radio, a fellow community radio station down in Baton Rouge. And we appreciate the grassroots radio programming that you bring to us up in here in Ames. And you can hear Robert's show Down the Road on KHOI every Friday at 2 p.m. Thank you, Robert. Any last words?
No, thank you. And
okay.
just Keep us in your minds, your thoughts, your prayers, and continue to support charities that will help here. The waters have gone down, but the situation is not over by any means. As your previous guest mentioned, it'll be a long slog for many tens of thousands of people.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you. And thank you. Bye-bye. You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. Thank you for joining us today. I've been your host, Ursula Rudenberg, and before speaking with Mr. Sherman, we spoke with Richard and Carolyn Newkirk, mental health workers from Ankeny, Ames musicians Red or Larry Stoltenberg, Ron Carson, Ken Johnson, and we also spoke with KHOI reporter Whitney Wright. Local Talk is on KHOI at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. And you can also listen to the show later online at khoifm.org. And Local Talk is engineered by Evan Taylor. Our theme song is Backtracking by Al Harris and Tom Richards. And if you enjoyed this show, tell your friends. And remember that your participation as audience is what makes KHOI possible and meaningful. Thank you for listening, and see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.